The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. My name is Jody Green, and I will be your host for today. I'm an extension educator with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and I'm an urban entomologist, which makes this one of my favorite topics. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into bed bugs, particularly exploring the question about their resurgence. During this time of COVID-19 restrictions and pandemic times, there has actually been a decrease of bedbug questions and concerns coming into my office, at least. But I anticipate when people start feeling comfortable enough to travel more, stay in hotels, and purchase and exchange goods and furniture, and host and entertain more company into their homes, that we will see an increase in bedbug issues. For this podcast, I dipped into some research and publications. I've leaned on Usinger's book that was published in 1966, called Monograph of Simicity. This was the first comprehensive publication on bedbugs and their relatives, like bat bugs, chicken bugs, swallow bugs, pigeon bugs, and others that do not have common names. Another important book that I've used is The Advances in the Biology and Management of Modern Bedbugs. The editors include Stephen Doggett, Deanie Miller, and Chaoyang Li. And there were over 60 contributing authors. This book was released in 2018, and this was the most expensive book that I had bought in years, and I refer to it quite often, and it actually sits on my bedside table. It focuses on the worldwide resurgence of the common bedbug, Cimex lectularis, and the tropical bedbug, Cimex hemipterus. I was also fortunate to interview Dr. Harold Harlan to talk about his personal experience with bedbugs and gather some insight as to his thoughts about bedbug resurgence and also his involvement with bedbug research throughout the years. I met Dr. Harlan last year in St. Louis at a MOVE symposium, and MOVE stands for Medical Urban Veterinary Entomology, and we got to talking and sharing some stories. I knew him as the entomologist who worked in the military, who collected bedbugs back in the 70s and then kept them alive by feeding them on himself for 30 years. He's going to tell us a little bit about how he grew up and how he didn't really think he was going to become an entomologist in those early days.
I accidentally became an entomologist. I was going to be an ag teacher when I first went to college. Choices were limited, and I came from We called ourselves tenant farmers in Ohio in that area. We lived in the edge of what was then called Appalachia. People were very poor. Our family moved 11 times during my 12 years of public education. So even though we stayed more or less within maybe a 50-mile radius or a little more of one spot, we kind of went all around that spot. I was in three different schools, but they were all within the overall one school district, included several counties. As tenant farmers, you depend upon the landlord to provide funding, land, resources to get seed or buy livestock. Mm-hmm. We did the work basically for a share of the crop, or a share of the sale from the livestock, et cetera. We farmed all different kinds of animals and plants. Dad was really good with raising hogs, so he had good success there, and then small grains. Corn was different, but we raised a little of everything. We did hay baling when I was first growing up. Commercially, he bought a baler before I was born, I guess, and they used to go around, my older brothers and him used to go around and bale hay for people for so much a bale. Mm-hmm. So they hired out for that. Plus we sheared sheep. There were six boys and I was second youngest. After school, one of us would go with him to do that work at night after he'd done whatever work in the field. And we each had chores morning and night because you had to take care of animals. You had to bring in wood. We cooked and heated everything by a wood stove or wood stoves. So, and we had well water from basically an uncovered well. It had a wooden top on it most of the time, various places we were. it was interesting. It was an interesting life. Learned to appreciate a lot of things that sometimes we don't.
Here's a little bit of Dr. Harlan talking about the things that make him tick.
Well, I've always been fascinated with parasites, particularly ectoparasites. My interests were a little broader in the sense that I began first working with things like fleas and later ticks, that sort of thing. But I'm fascinated at how ectoparasites and parasites in general make a living. It's intriguing. Bed bugs, and I found them interesting for several reasons.
Bed bugs are an insect that feed on the blood of humans, but as you will find out from Dr. Harlan, they may also feed on other organisms like bats and birds in the absence of a human host. The bed bug that we are referring to in this podcast is Cimex lectularis, the human bed bug, which is a cosmopolitan species that has been found infesting human communities throughout time. There's no scientific evidence that bed bugs are able to transmit diseases to humans. According to the World Health Organization, vectors are living organisms that transmit infectious disease between humans or from animal to humans. Bedbugs are able to harbor 40 different pathogens, but there is no evidence at this time to show that they are competent vectors. Bedbugs are, however, a public health concern. Bedbug bites may cause an allergic reaction for some hosts, but each person may react differently or not react at all. Besides physical responses to the feeding of bedbugs, people who have dealt with a bedbug infestation often suffer psychological stress, social anxiety, and economic consequences. One of the questions I hear most often is, where did bedbugs come from? It is assumed that bedbugs evolved from bat bugs, and that bat bugs were ectoparasites of bats, then they evolved to survive on humans because humans lived in caves before there were man-made dwellings. But this has been highly speculative because people during these times did not occupy caves or rock shelters in Europe, the Middle East, or in India. And now, as scientists have studied bedbugs and bat bugs, they have found that there is no gene flow between the two species. And in experiments where bat bugs and bedbugs were bred together to produce offspring, these offspring were less fit and less fertile. In a recent study from the University of Sheffield's Department of Animal Science and Plant Science in 2019, researchers used DNA from bugs collected from all over the world to suggest that bedbugs existed 10 million years ago, long before bats even evolved. And so therefore, bats could not be the first animal host. It is still not clear what organism could have been the host for the first bedbugs. Dinosaurs in the Cretaceous period were around, but they were unlikely the host. So we know that bedbugs have been around for a long time. And 50 million years ago, when bats evolved, the bedbugs were living in the caves, started feeding on the bats. And when humans coexisted in these caves, they switched hosts from bats to humans. And then later, when humans moved into man-made structures, bedbugs followed them. There is fossil evidence from caves that date back to 11,000 years ago. The documentation of bedbugs throughout history is evidenced in literary sources such as folklore, plays, sayings, poems, and medicinal stories. The first mention of bedbugs in recorded history was in Greece during 400 BC, and later bedbugs were found to spread to different countries, with mentions being in Italy in 77 AD, China in 600 AD, Germany in the 1100s, and France in the 13th century. The first mention of bedbugs in the English language was in 1583, and that's when they began to spread throughout Europe. They arrived in the Americas by early European colonists in the 1700s, and then later found in Canada in the 1800s and in New Zealand in 1922. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, bedbugs spread throughout the cities, which is likely due to the use of electric heating, which provided a favorable place for bedbugs to always have a host and stay warm. In the early 1900s, most households had experienced bedbugs, and in 1939, big cities like Chicago and New York had community-wide initiatives to fight bedbugs. Bedbugs were also becoming a huge problem on military bases during World War II, as bugs infested soldiers' barracks, in the bedding, backpacks, helmets, and in warships.
One of my mentors in the Army, entomology, was a Dr. Gerberg, became a full colonel entomologist as a reserve entomologist. he was called to active duty in the beginning of World War II, and the basic training sites, one was Fort Lee, Virginia. They had serious issues with bed bugs at that time in the barracks, and the things they had to do to get rid of them in 1942, I believe it was. So I wasn't born yet, but they would essentially, they had a caustic, wasn't really a lye, but it was something like that. There was a real caustic solution they would use to wash down the walls and the beds, the bunks were wooden. They would do that, and they would take the springs, they would clean the mattresses and then and bedding, and they would put them in this great big autoclave-like thing. They would steam clean them. They would do this all in one continuous process through each barracks, and then go to the next barracks that had them. And they would wash down the walls of the barracks, and they would close the barracks up. I don't know what they used, whether it was oil cloth, like we used to have. That was our tablecloth. They would close the building up as much as they could, and then they would go in and use essentially hydrogen cyanide as a gas to fumigate literally each barracks.
The time in World War II that he was referring to was the time before the use of DDT, which was probably just about to be used at that time. The insecticidal property of DDT was discovered in 1939, but not used in World War II until 1942. It was found to be effective against bedbugs as a residual product and applied as an oil base or a powder, first in World War II, and then later released for widespread use and application for homeowners. This is when the community-wide effort to control bedbugs became an individual battle of human versus bedbugs. Here's Dr. Harlan talking about his first experience with bedbugs.
I was a kid. We had an infestation in one of those places we lived. Oh, yeah, and this was... I was like six to seven at that time. And then later when I was nine, we had another infestation where we lived. And my parents, they were familiar with them from years back. They'd been more or less, less common recently for them, but they didn't think a lot about it. They just progressed to, mom washed everything and all the clothes and bedclothes and washed down the bed. We had bars of lye soap at the time, and that was one of the used that for bathing. Actually, they took care of them fairly quickly, and there were some things they did then that we wouldn't be able to do now, or it wouldn't be considered reasonable practice. For one of the first things they did was they stripped the beds and began soaking and washing all that, where there were certain beds they were in, they weren't in all our beds, and they put the beds on, got a flat rock, you'll go out and whatever you can find outside for this or that. They put a flat rock in any large flat can. We had, I don't know if you're familiar with what we used to call salmon cans. Salmon used to come in an oval can, and it was packed. The can was about an inch and a half deep, depending on the brand. And once you'd taken the salmon out or left that can, it was kind of like the sardine can. In fact, it was kind of like a big sardine can with a different shape. So we had cans like that, or in some cases, we actually used sardine cans. Sardines and salmon were kind of a delicacy for us. We couldn't afford much. They put a can under each bedpost with a flat rock. They weren't all the same size, but it didn't make much difference to the bed. And then they poured about a half an inch of kerosene in each of the cans. Mm-hmm. And that isolated the bed. That they just knew that's what you're supposed to do. And they would wipe down the beds that they could wipe down with kerosene, just, put a pair of gloves on. Mm-hmm. They didn't have much. They had there were these heavy rubber gloves for some uses, and they had a pair or so of those, and they did all that throughout the house, and that pretty much took care of them. We ended the infestation. I think they left them for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, mm-hmm. something like that. They left them for a month, roughly, it seems to me. I don't remember some specifics, but, and they'd keep watching for anything like that. But basically, they did the right things without knowing what they were doing.
Yeah.
In terms of our modern approach to things.
Yeah.
They didn't even think of it as isolating the bed. They just said keep them from crawling off, come up off the floor or wherever they were.
It was never a question of, where did we get this or where did it come from?
No, it was one of those things.
They were just there.
You know, it just, you know, you got them, get rid of them.
But it even seems like, besides the kerosene part, right? I mean, those are the times, but common sense in that, okay, this is a little bit of a problem. Let's take care of it. Nowadays, there's just so much panic that they do all the wrong things before they actually call and ask what the right thing is to do.
Sure. You know, and we didn't communicate with other people as much.
Right.
We didn't go to common areas and all that. We didn't interact with them very often. If you went to church or you went to school, those were your social connections.
Right.
So when you go to the grocery store or whatever, usually it was a small grocery store, and wasn't much chance for transferring them then as now.
In the mid-1940s, the application of DDT led to a near elimination of bedbug infestations for North America. However, there were still some bedbug populations that still existed. Here's Dr. Harlan talking about what he saw when he was in Fort Dix, New Jersey in 1972.
I'll sort of give you a timeline, if I may. I had not seen them from that time, which was in the, let me think, 9 years old. It had been 54, 55, the last time we had them physically that I was aware of. Mm-hmm. So from that time, I had not seen bedbugs until I was assigned to Fort Dix, New Jersey, after I'd been to Vietnam. That came back to that assignment. And about a year and a half into that, or a little less, there was an infestation in one of the basic training barracks. So that's where I first saw them again. And I was fascinated. Now I could appreciate, being an entomologist by then, I could appreciate much more about them. And I was curious about them. And I was asked to go check out this biting problem. Could have been, mm-hmm. you know, people were aware of fleas and ticks and those things, and nobody knew what was going on in the barracks because there was no brush right outside. The windows had screens on them and all that. So they assumed it was, you know, there was some mystery bug there. Mm-hmm. So when I went and examined where the event was going on, I saw these, and I had not seen bed bugs since I was a kid. So I wasn't sure what they were. So I collected a bunch into a mason jar and just screwed the lid on it, put some paper towels in there to start, because I wanted to keep them alive and look at them, observe them. And so I picked up whatever of them I could, and then I went back and identified them. They were bed bugs, and there were recommendations for treating various things. And that was what they thought of, was you find it, you kill it. That's, you know, or you clean the area out and then kill what's left of any pest. And different people did the control than did the surveillance. I was on the surveillance end, so and taking care of people and figuring out what was biting them, that sort of thing, preventive medicine. So I had to hand off treating them to the facilities, civilian employees at a facilities engineering was what they called it. Mm-hmm. At each post, they had their own office to do that. And so I had to contact them, and then I had to tell them, give them the published guidance as to how to take care of them. So they did, and they mostly got it to work, but then there was a little more of a problem about 10 days later. So they came back and they treated it again. Well, there were things available then that aren't now. They had a choice of carbamates. They had, they were new, but diazinon, malathion, both of those were available as both a sort of an emulsion mm-hmm. formulation they could use, or they could, diazinon was available in a, it wasn't kerosene, but it was in an organic, some organic solvent, might have been diesel fuel that they were using. Anyway, whatever it was formulated mm-hmm. into, there was a formal commercial product available that they could order through their supply system, and they use it right out of the can. It was 0.5%. And so that's what they chose to use. But I gave them choices, that or the malathion, and there was a wettable powder, and, you know, all those choices they had. And there were dusts available too. Lindane dust. They were still able to use lindane dust.
If you didn't notice, there was no mention of DDT as a viable treatment option during this time. DDT was criticized due to the environmental impact in the 1960s, and it was banned for agricultural use in 1972. By the mid-1950s, some bedbug populations were found to have developed insecticide resistance to DDT due to its extensive use.
So they had all those choices, but they used diazinon direct application solvent solution. And after the second treatment, it all kind of went away. Further, the barracks were being phased out, so there weren't people in the middle of all that. There were very few people around for them to live on. So they were kind of concentrated on certain beds, which was good. I collected a lot quickly.
If you want to know more about Harold Harlan, there's a great cover story that was published in PCT Magazine in 2011. There's a picture of him featured with a few bedbug specimens on the back of his hand. The headline reads, "Love at First Bite." The article features Harold Harlan as a military entomologist in the U.S. Army who had fed 5,000 bedbugs a month on himself, all in the name of science. At the time of the PCT article, Harlan had kept bugs in his home for 38 years.
And I just kept observing them. And from there, I would show live ones in a little bottle. I'd partition them out and, you know, pick a few out after I'd feed them. But I had to sort of place them on myself to feed them then. I had to take the little pieces of paper. I went to pieces of filter paper for simplicity. And I would take them out of the jar with a pair of tweezers and put them on my arm to let them feed the ones that would feed, and then put them back in the jar after they'd fed, or the ones that weren't interested in feeding, I'd put them back in the jar. And that's how I maintained them. I would only feed them maybe once a month or something like that at that time. But they were just such a curiosity. You show them the yuck factor, but some people were interested enough to actually watch what they did. And for real kick, I'd let them feed on me or something, you know, they look at me like I was, like I had three heads. I kept doing this and I kept numbers available. I contributed a bunch to the medical entomology people at Ohio State. My advisor there was one of Usinger's students. And wow. Dr. Woodbridge Foster, Woody, he actually did the crosses, the lab crosses of those various species that Usinger was trying to see the genetics of. And so he even cites him in the book as, you know, doing that. And he had worked for his master's, I think it was. His master's degree was on swallow bugs, Eastiacus, mm-hmm. and cliff swallow bugs. And he did an interesting study on those. And so some of his friends wanted specimens. Well, at the time, I had provided 3 years of classes while I was there in 82 through 84. But there were some other people that began being interested at that time. So I provided them as research specimens to, I sent Cliff Hoffa some, and he was delighted with that because he had classes still. That was in his last years of teaching. And also Pete Teal, I mentioned, and Jamie Blow, who she did her dissertation work on at Michigan State under Walker, Ned Walker, on whether or not they could transmit hepatitis B. And she did a really great study about that. The bedbugs were a piece of it. And so I provided her a start and a restart and a restart because somebody always makes a mistake and kills them all.
When you don't want them to die, they die. And when you want them to live,
yeah, sometimes I think it's on purpose. So not occasionally people would want them, and I'd send a few specimens just to be omis for people. Public health people had an interest now and then. But I more or less was just maintaining them, except in certain periods of time there from 73 until I started working with the NPMA in 96, late 96, and then full time in January 97. In February of that year, I won't give specific names because they would be embarrassed now. He doesn't need an advertising agent. He is his own. But he called me one day and asked if I'd ever heard of bed bugs. I thought he was setting me up. I thought he was, they're jokers among us, I'm sure you're aware. Mm-hmm. So I said, yes, I was cautious. And he said, the very first thing he asked me was, are they real? And I said, yes, they're real. He said, well, where can I find out about them? I'm getting questions about them. I told him, if you like, I'm maintaining them. He said, you're maintaining them? And, you know, it was one of those sorts of things. And I said, well, yes, I can send you some that you can look at. And all he said, where would I find enough to start up a colony to to work with so I can begin to test them for chemical control, et cetera. And I said, well, how many hundred do you want? Mm-hmm. And there was silence for a moment. And then he said, well, he gave me an estimate of, I don't know, 500 or 600 or whatever. And I said, well, if you want them as a mixed population, I could send those out in a week or so. And he just, again, there was a little silence. And then he began to question me all kinds of things about them. So I gave him Usinger and some other more recent references on specific studies at the time.
We really don't know for certain why bedbugs returned, but is likely due to many factors. The resurgence that we're talking about started in the late 1990s and first started in New York, Chicago, and Cincinnati. In those big cities, they first reported infestations, and then they started to spread rapidly, occurring around the world and not just in the United States. In 2002 to 2003, Orkin Pest Control reported a 543% increase in bedbug calls. And in 2006, all 50 states had some experience with bedbugs.
That's when they were beginning to become cool again. So in that big gap from way back when, you know, even 73, they were a rarity. So about 1997 was when they began becoming cool again.
Close to when I got to the States, or when I went to Purdue back in like 2001, bedbugs were coming back at that time. I had never heard about bedbugs before. And so it was really interesting to me. I had to do a lot of reading of what was there at that time to find out about these.
You should have called me. I could have explained that.
We always talk about bedbugs being pretty much wiped out or non-existent during this time. What did Dr. Harlan think during this time that they were not cool? Did they really disappear?
Probably the extensive use of all kinds of chemicals sort of suppressed them in homes in developed countries. And they were still active in, I'll call them, developing countries. And maybe what some people call third world countries, there were populations around the world still feeding on people, et cetera. And so they were out there and they were occasionally introduced into developed countries. Something that was kind of ignored, and that maybe in the literature you're reaching from not just the US, but other areas, like I'm trying to think, there may have been some in Canada, but more likely the warmer areas, Mexico or some of the Southern European or the Middle Eastern countries, they were an issue with chickens, commercially reared chickens and layers. They were serious problems in the consolidated houses we began to develop in the 70s. So they were a real issue. And while I was with NPMA, they were a serious issue in the egg factory type things where they had rows and rows and rows of layers in one long building or where they were raising poultry for, like on the Eastern Shore here, some big name in Arkansas, that area where they raised millions of chickens for at various stages of their life. They would be harvested either for broilers or fryers. You know, they had their terms. They were an issue because of thriftiness or lack of thriftiness. And also they would put speckles on the eggs where they'd go to the egg and since it was warm, they might poop on it. So, you know, things like that. So they were an issue and they still are occasionally. And then from there, they just became cool again throughout the world. We began to spread around everywhere and we stopped using residual chemicals in our homes, which gave them free rein to go wherever they wanted, more or less. And we didn't. Biggest thing was, I think, as far as how they spread so quickly in developed countries, we had forgotten about them. It had been maybe 3 decades since they were a serious pest in developed countries, Western Europe and the United States and Canada and even developed countries in Asia. They were a rarity. So we forgot about them. The common sense that I was referring to, the population of the general public, and even the people that control them, whether it's the public health people that are called in to take care of a human pest or the pest control people at those periods, didn't know, first of all, what they were. But once they knew what they were, they threw up their hands regarding what to do about them. That was a big issue. I think they're going to be with us for a long time, to answer your one question. I think the reasons that they disappeared were multiple reasons. One, we began to use chemicals that, instead of killing them and eliminating them, although it might have, it starved them. They couldn't get to us because they were unwilling to cross it. And sanitation improved and our houses got to be tighter. On the other hand, once you introduce a bug into that setting, it's a great habitat. So they thrive if they have people to feed on. But another thing is we've increased our international movement of people and things. And if you move a bug, they can live, mine have lived for over 6 months when I was deployed somewhere. I went to Saudi Arabia and nobody was going to feed them while I was gone. And so they lived at least 9 months, but I keep them cool. Yeah. And in cool settings, they survive longer without feeding. I've starved them unintentionally 4 or 5 months, and all stages except the brand new hatchlings are ready to feed the moment it's presented. And there was a study out of Penn State that showed, and another out of Florida, University of Florida, that showed that they can survive any given stage for at least 2 months without feeding again. After they've had their first blood meal, they can survive, that individual will be able to survive 2 months at temperatures and humidities that are comfortable for people, 2 months without any further feeding.
I think now that people are traveling again, if all these months that, it, you know, in a hotel, if there was a bed bug there and they didn't get fed, they're going to be hungry.
Indeed.
But do you still have a colony? Do you still feed bed bugs?
No, I have a jar I haven't tried recently, but I haven't fed them in 8.5, almost 9 months since I fed any of them. And I doubt they're alive. I will check, but I intentionally got rid of them because so many people have my strain, if you will. And I have personal friends at places that I've provided those to, particularly the guy in Simon Fraser, Grise, one of his students. I helped him along and I gave him a start and then a restart and then another restart. I cautioned him, if you're going to raise things on blood, you have to be careful where you get your blood. Mm-hmm. Not just any blood's going to work. And when his blood source had run out, he went out to a local abattoir, a local chicken slaughtering place, and took blood that they had. And, you know, he strained it and all that sort of thing. But he forgot about whether they might have dusted the chickens that were processed before all his colony died. And he was desperate. Suddenly he had nothing to work with. Fortunately, I had a bunch at the time that were, I was able to send him more than enough to replace what he had. All he had to do was sort them out and age them and get them fed at the right stages. But it was like he didn't have to start over completely, and his work up to then was not gone. I've provided specimens like that to more than 100 different labs over the, since 97 or before that. I counted about a half dozen before that that I gave starts to, but it's been more than 100 labs.
During the time that bedbugs were in his home and care, they were not exposed to insecticides, so they were considered the susceptible strain. Anyone formulating and testing new chemicals for the use of bedbug control would need these type of specimens to test. If the Harlan strain doesn't die after exposure, it is unlikely that any compound formulated will kill wild populations.
So that's why people wanted them, was, but also they wanted them because they were available and free. I just asked them to pay for shipment, but yeah. Other than that, and it's a good manageable critter, and a lot of people are using it, so you have kind of a comparison with other studies, if you wish.
Personally, I can't imagine feeding a colony of bedbugs on myself. I am super sensitive, and I've been told by Dr. Harlan that I should not feed them anymore due to my skin reactions. Here's Dr. Harlan talking about his reactions.
I still get two different levels, and I shouldn't, feeding all those thousands and thousands. I shouldn't have done that, but I still got an immediate and a delayed reaction from the mid-70s when I began feeding them with some regularity. I would get a delayed reaction. That's what usually you get, no reaction when you first feed them, then a delayed reaction of like anywhere from 10 to 21 days after feeding. That's the delayed reaction. Then when you feed more, or you feed more numbers, or you feed a number of times in a row, you will get an immediate reaction. So within less than a day, and usually within hours, you'll get an immediate reaction. And at the same spot, you'll get a week or two later, you'll get, that'll flare up again without, you know, when you know you haven't had any more feeding there. So that's an immediate and delayed reaction. And then if you feed more and more, you get to a point where you get just the immediate reaction in theory. And if you continue to feed them more or greater numbers, you'll reach a point where you don't react to them anymore. Your IgGs circulating in your blood grab them off, grab all the antigens off right away. I never reached that stage. I always had an immediate and delayed reaction all those years up until I quit feeding them last fall. So I figure my blood's goofy or something.
You
but
feel
anyway.
Better? Like, do you feel different now that you don't feed bed bugs?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know.
You would think after feeding all of these bed bugs, Dr. Harlan would be someone who doesn't react to bed bug bites. I was really shocked to hear about his reactions and how he still continued to feed and care for his bugs.
One thing you might consider, and this is something Dr. Foster taught me about, he considered himself a mosquito nutritionist. Can you imagine that? Anyway, his mosquitoes were his big thing. He got into mosquito biology and nutrition and became well known for the sugar feeding research he did for mosquitoes. And that was his bag later in years. He retired recently. I guess last year he retired. And he taught me that after you feed, and particularly bed bugs, but other things, mosquitoes too, if you feed a lot of them, like you're feeding them in a lab, you want them to feed on people for some experiment. With his experiments, grad students had to be participating as well. So, but as soon as you can, after you're through feeding them, run that under as hot water as you can possibly stand. I mean, to where the heat hurts a little bit, and that will deactivate a lot of the salivary proteins that they've left in your body. It'll reduce your body's reaction to it.
Here's Dr. Harlan talking about some feeding observations of bed bugs that some of us may never see.
I was always fascinated. I'd watch what they did, and the brand new little ones, when they feed, they look like a Christmas ornament. They haven't any dark blood in them because they had not digested any blood. And I have an image of one that has filled its body and it is micturating. There's a little tiny droplet of clear fluid at its back end. But there's an awful lot of stuff. If you watch what they do when they're feeding, I've done that many times. They hold their antennae differently when they're beginning to feed, when they're first finding a host, then they begin to feed and their antennae sort of relax and move back along their head, along toward the sides of their body when they're actually pumping blood in. So interesting stuff like that. And then when they're ready to pull out, they wiggle and the antennae come forward, etc. When they probe, they put saliva in. Whether they find a venule that they like, if you will, or if they like, find one they like the taste of, it, so to speak, if they find a suitable vein or vessel, they will fill up with blood the first time they do that. And they may probe a number of times before they find that, either because you might have used a lotion or something on your hands, or maybe there just isn't a good vein where they're trying. So, or a good vessel where they're trying. But every time they probe, they do salivate in that probe. I wouldn't call it a lubricant, but the mandibles going in, mandibles and maxillae going in, are lubricated by their saliva. And so they leave some proteins behind that, you know, they don't suck it back up. So each bite could be where you see a lot of those all over somebody's body or all over some part of some person's body. I'd look around and see if there aren't a whole lot of bugs there where they might have, you know, like if they were laying along the edge of the bed and it was all along that arm, they may have had a lot of bugs biting. If it was all from one set of bites, you'd have expansion from each spot. I've fed mine intentionally on various animals, and I found that back in the 70s when I was first fiddling with that, I was in an army lab that we were raising mosquitoes and other things, test them for susceptibility. So we had to feed blood. We used rats and we had chickens for the culex because they don't feed well on, they will if you force, you know, if you give them no other choice, they'll feed on mammals, but they prefer birds. So for the maximum egg production and the maximum quick buildup of your colony so you can test hundreds and hundreds, you feed them on the best host. So I tried my bugs on the chickens we were using and also on the rats we were using and on myself. And on the chickens, my bugs produced in that one period when I tested for, you know, a couple months, my bugs would produce 3 or 4% more eggs on chickens than they did on me And on the rats, they didn't do well at all. They'd produce like 80 or 85% of the numbers. So, you know, it was rather loose. It wasn't real precise, but there were definitely more eggs produced per female on the chickens than on me, which kind of surprised me.
Did you find a lot on pets ever?
There have been cases I've seen where they adapted to a dog, and usually it was either a short-haired dog or one that had recently been clipped, and they build up on that dog, and it's like any host is better than no host.
Right.
If they're desperate for feeding, they'll feed on a lot of different things. Mm. So if there are people near, and this has been from a lot of different cases, particularly while I was at NVMA, if there are people near to where they are, they will switch from whatever they're feeding on to people. I didn't ever have bats to look at, but in cases where bats are available, they'll feed readily on them too. They'll feed readily on pretty much any warm-blooded animal.
I know my family would not be comfortable having a colony of bedbugs in our home, but I was really curious to find out if the Harlan household had any escapees.
I've had these escape in my house three different times. Twice it was local in the downstairs where I worked at one sort of a table and chair. They had escaped, and I limited that population and eliminated the escapees pretty quickly. The third time, we were in a situation where she was working full time, but she would go to work very early in the morning at the job she had. She would be getting up at 5 o'clock and going in, you know, to that job. And she would go to bed a couple of hours before I did. She'd be in bed by 10 o'clock, and I usually didn't go to bed till nearly midnight. She was developing, you know, little rash spots every now and then, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And one night I was doing something at the computer here very late, and she brought in a fully engorged late nymph and said, "What is this?" She knew very well what it was. And I said, "Where did you get it?" And she said, "It was on me." And so I said, "Oops." We went in there to the bed and looked, and her corner, the head of the bed, was just a classic infestation. It was, and this had been going on for, you know, several months that she'd been having these issues. It was getting worse and worse, and so we didn't do anything illegal, but we went through some extreme measures quickly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we got rid of them. They had gotten on stuff at the head and you know, on the headboard and the mattress, and it was just classic. And I was so tempted to stop and take a picture of that, but I figured if I did, I'd be signing divorce papers.
As you heard here today, there are multiple reasons bedbugs disappeared from many households between the 1950s and the early 1990s, and there are even more reasons for the resurgence. Dr. Harlan mentioned changes in pest management practices, which included a decrease in indoor residual treatments, an increase in international travel, the significant bedbug infestations in poultry barns around the world, and the lack of education about bedbugs and their management as reasons for this resurgence. To expand on this list, we cannot ignore the development of insecticide resistance in bedbug populations. According to the Insect Resistance Action Committee, IRAC, insecticide resistance is defined as a heritable change in the sensitivity of a pest population that is reflected in the repeated failure of a product to achieve the expected level of control when used according to the label recommendation for that pest species. Insecticide resistance makes it so that bedbugs no longer are affected by the product that used to kill them at the same rate that previously controlled them. Three resistance mechanisms have been discovered in bedbugs, which include metabolic resistance by increased activity of detoxification enzymes, reduced penetration through structural and biochemical changes in the cuticle, where it is thickened and remodeled, and target site resistance through knockdown mutations that reduces the affinity of the insecticide to reach the target site. Bedbugs have shown to be resistant to synthetic pyrethroids, neonicotinoids, and pyrroles. There are a few other things I want to mention because I feel they have also contributed to the rise in bedbugs in the last 20 years. There is an increase in the population densities in hotels and multifamily housing facilities, which means we are putting more people into smaller places like senior living centers, hotels, cruise ships, and college dorms. All of these places include a living space intended for sleep, which are all locations where bedbugs could become established. With the high turnover rate and movement of people locally and internationally, we have the ability to transport a large number of bedbugs all over the place and in all types of communities. To add, we use a variety of modes of transportation these days, including planes, trains, school buses, taxis, and rideshare companies like Lyft and Uber. Lack of reaction to bites is also a contributing factor as to why bedbug infestations may have increased where we least expect them. There is a large portion of the population that have no reaction to the saliva injected by bedbugs, and therefore these individuals would not be discomforted or inclined to look for the telltale signs of a bedbug infestation. Early detection and proper management is the key to effective long-term bedbug control. In these situations, bedbugs are only recognized when populations become so large that bedbugs can no longer hide effectively in the cracks and crevices near the sleeping area of the host. The senior population, those 65 years of age and older, have shown to have a greater proportion of non-reactors. With the natural decline in eyesight and the strength needed to lift a mattress to check for bedbugs, an infestation could have been established months before they are ever detected, often after they've been transported to friends, family, and other places unknowingly. From the stories we heard from Dr. Harlan about bedbug behavior, the ability to successfully use alternative hosts, and the power to go months without a blood meal, bedbugs are unlikely to be eliminated. Entomologists and educators like myself still have a lot of work to do to help empower the public and the pest industry to stop the panic and put into action science-based integrated pest management. There is still a stigma associated with bedbugs, but the truth is they do not discriminate. They can infest any place where they are introduced, provided there is an appropriate blood source and a place to hide. And while it doesn't matter to bedbugs your race, gender, age, or economic situation, it does matter when it comes to treating an infestation because it can be time-consuming, costly, and intensive. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Arthropod. I hope you found it interesting to learn about the history of bedbugs and their management. I would like to extend a huge thank you to Dr. Harold Harlan, who has done so much for bedbug research and given me the encouragement to continue my educational programs in urban entomology. If you'd like to check out our website, you can find our show on arthro-pod.blogspot.com. If you want to know more about bedbugs, please go back and check out episode 54 and 55. And earlier this year, we did a two-parter about DDT, and those were episodes 74 and 75. You can find this podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, or any other podcatcher app, and our show's Twitter handle is arthro_podshow. My name is Jody Green, and my Twitter handle is JodyBugsMeUNL. Please join us again soon when my co-hosts and I will be back to bug you on another episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.